Welcome to 21. I'm Drew Lasker. I'm a family man, professional athlete, and business owner of Train Harder 21 and 21 Media. Yvonne Harris and I have teamed up and created this podcast to explore the life lessons that come along with being an athlete. Why 21? It's my jersey number and a key part to my great fortune and career. So it seems fitting for this podcast.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Harris. I'm a proud boy mom and an advocate for efforts that improve the lives of women and children. Experiencing success as an athlete or in any facet of life does not happen by accident. There must be clarity, intention, and the willingness to pivot. Our guests on 21 share their journeys in ways that cause you to reflect, assess, and then take action. We are so thankful for the stories shared on this podcast because Drew and I know their wisdom shortens someone else's path to success. Enjoy this episode of 21.
Welcome back to the 21 Podcast. We catch back up today where we left off last episode, speaking to author, writer, and producer Marcus Guillory. We pick up where Marcus discusses the reaction he received from his first book, Read Now and Laters. Enjoy.
I really expected a bigger reception from Houston and Louisiana than I got. And honestly, man, that broke my heart. And you know what's crazy? Attica Locke warned me not to think like that. Attica's a famous author from Houston, also does TV. Jean Locke's daughter, fantastic writer, her and her sister Kimba. And when I first put the book together and stuff, and I reached out to her, she told me straight up, say, look, I'm gonna tell you right now, look, your friends aren't going to read it. Your family aren't going to read it because that's just how it is. Either people are readers or they're not. They're going to buy it and it's going to look great on their coffee table. So get some good art. But if they don't read it, don't trip. And if the crib don't read it, don't trip. And I was like, but it's about the crib. It's this time in Houston where, you know, it's fun. And you got, you know, a lot of the literary fiction authors, a lot of my colleagues, I mean, these are friends, they're big names, but a lot of their books, they're like the awkward boy watching life from the window. And that's their novel. And they get Pulitzer Prizes and stuff like that. I was the kid that was outside. Yeah, missing curfew and I would be out, man. So you got to go have that kind of experience. And I wanted it to be fun. You know, hey, mama sleep. Let's sneak out the house. Let's go. You know, that kind of energy. And it's a trip. I don't regret it. It got, like I said, man, it made some noise. And I did get some accolades from the city.
You know? So Marcus, I read your book, loved your book, thankful that you wrote the book. But did I blow it by having it on the console behind me?
I was actually thinking about that as he was saying that.
I love the book. Love it to death. I mean, it's so personal. It's interesting because it man, you know, if you want to know me, go read that. That's one part of the journey. But, you know, it's all fine. It's, you know, I got over that. You know, I definitely learned a lot about the literary world, that and how it operates and who buys books and how to manage your expectations. And
it's like the local musician who isn't really accepted until they go off and are loved out of town. I mean,
there's the medium changes, you know. So, like, you know, like I remember when during the writer's strike, and I was producing a reality show called Snoop Dogg's Fatherhood. Now, all of a sudden, people hitting me up because they see my name on TV. That was just the beginning. And then when they start seeing more stuff and more stuff and more stuff, then it's like, you know, it's interesting because you go home and some kids say, man, you're still doing that writing shit. As opposed to being a lawyer, because for a lot of us folks, a lawyer, senior lawyer, doctor is a status symbol. So we'll kind of stay in that space. And it's interesting what they decide that they're going to remember about you. You know, like, oh, we talking about, dude, I haven't been a lawyer in a really long time. And this writing shit, well, depending on your value system, this writing shit is paying me pretty well. So if that's what's important to you, then you sound crazy, right? But you let people experience you the way they choose to experience you. And I can say that now with having music and all so much stuff out there and having fans. you know, and when you deal with them sometimes, and it depends on what it is that they gravitate towards. I'll give you an example. I created a thing called Lit House, which is literature and house music. One of the most gratifying, that first album, we did excerpts from my novel in the music of the tracks I was making. And so, and that song, that album now is considered a classic in the house world. There's one song called Sucre Sacré. And I knew if it would work, it was gonna shut it down. Cause usually with house music, everybody put poetry in it, spoken word and all of that. I put prose in it. The last time anybody was really rocking like that was Kerouac in the 50s with jazz. And I was very aware of that. And so was Simon & Schuster. And so was Yoruba Records and Defected. I was doing something different. When sure it was going to work. At dusk, the wind blows gently through fields of cane, singing to Azaka, reporting to concern Loa as the red sky begins its journey to dawn. What I remember about that line was trying to describe what sunset would look like against a field of sugarcane, having seen it in Marksville and in Ville Platte, Louisiana, and giving it a language and a descriptiveness that's deferential and has a little bit of magic to it. That was the beginning of a chapter in Red Nihilators. That was the beginning of a song, Sucre Sacré, that blew up around the world. At some point, a young boy from South Africa had emailed me with what he wanted to confirm were the lyrics. And he wrote down what he heard. He had most of it right, did not realize it came from a novel. What was dope about that was the reason I did Lit House, to bring literature to house music. And the fact that this kid who loves house music, normally you don't pay attention, there's hardly any lyrics in it, if ever. But the fact that you're going to respond to the lyrics, artistically, that was satisfying. It's like, shit, I did. I pulled it off. And it went from there. I had a bunch of hits after that. You know, the Baldwin song was huge. The Critic was huge. You know, I had about a good 7 years of just DJing all over the place and putting out records, remixes, stuff like that while writing. And that kind of just became, you know, what the lifestyle was. And then when people would hang out with me, they'd realize, yo, it's not a gimmick. That's how he gets down. And it's interesting, because if you would have told me when I started at that law firm at 24 that I'd be doing that, I'd say, she crazy. You're talking about me, I'm a lawyer, you know?
Yeah. I wasn't exposed to house music until I went to college.
Yeah, you know, we didn't come up.
Same here.
You know, I found a lane and I rocked in it. And the thing that's interesting, and what I tell folks, another thing is a jewel, a good plan is a plan that can change. Say that again. A good plan is a plan that can change. If the plan can't change, some people say, no, you have to stick to, I hear that. But a good plan is a plan that can change. Because if you can, and you got to be able to see, man, can I turn this? You know, I meet a ton of people, man, like that want to do some side stuff. Had dinner with some folks last night with that, right? And I think one of the problems is folks are so anxious to announce what they're doing before they really doing it. I call it window shopping. Mm. So anxious to live their best life and tell you what I'm about to start a dental line, girl, and I'm about to go do this master class on. Shut up and talk about it is out. Why? Because when you announce it, I'm giving y'all a good game today. I used to charge for this.
Man.
Announce it, you put pressure on yourself that you don't have to have. A close friend of mine that's anxious to tell you that he's going to start painting or he's going to start doing, and he tells people this. Well, what happens when he sees them again 3 months later? Hey, how's the painting going? Now he feels crummy. If he would have shut up, he wouldn't have had that pressure. Sometimes you keep it quiet, you work on it, and then when you roll it out, oh yeah, I was working on this. Oh, damn. You don't need, the world is complicated enough. And it's difficult to get a dollar. You don't need to create problems and extra pressure for yourself. So that window shopping, don't talk about all that.
Less announcements. That's for sure.
What I'm saying is that, and to get to what you're about to say, I used to give advice for a living. Now let's start right there. I'm doing all this other stuff. I spent 4 to 5 years advising some of the most talented people in the world about their career. People whose records you bought, people whose movies you seen. you know, and I had to give them advice in certain situations. So, you know, I was fortunate to be in a law firm with two of the oldest Black entertainment lawyers in history who taught me a lot, not just about the law, but how to handle people, how to give good advice, how to look at someone's situation. And I always say, well, what do they want? And what do they need? Do they understand the difference? And where can they go if they get from here to there? Things that they don't see for themselves. I call it pulling a plane up to 30,000. Sometimes you'd be in the trenches with something. It might be traumatic. It's some personal stuff happening with some business stuff. You're like, oh my God, you know what? Pull your plane up a little bit. See a bigger picture. You'll find the answer sometimes, or at least figure out how to deal with it. Real talk.
Man, you preaching on here. And I must say, you're really intriguing. I'm pretty sure you've heard that before. But one part that I'm really interested in is your personal creative process. I know for me, a lot of my creative thoughts come when I'm driving in the car in silence. So for you, when you're trying to get into your zone, this writer's space, is there a certain setting that you have to have, or just talk to us a little bit about where your inspiration comes from?
Well, it's different now because it's like half the day is spent on servicing other people's stories. You know, so I might be writing a film for someone or a company or a TV show or something. So there's that, and that requires time and whatever. Most important thing that you can do to be successful in that area is learn how to compartmentalize, certainly your emotions. You are your worst enemy, period. You are your biggest obstacle. That's almost anything, really. Once you get past that, then sky's the limit. The process of it and getting involved in it can make you feel very self-centered, because that's what it is. What people always say that. Civilians say that about ours. Oh, they selfish, they self-centered. What they don't understand is that, you know, when you're an artist or an entrepreneur, because I put them in the same category, you got to eat what you kill. And if you ain't out there killing it, you ain't eating. You know, it's not like going to work somewhere from 10 to 6 and getting a check every other week. That's a different kind of living. And I've done that before, and that's fine. That's civilian living. That's cool. But it means that you have to know who you are and what you do and what the market pays for it. And understand the amount of time, you know, like that. The rule of 10,000 hours is absolutely true. If you got to put the time in, you can't side hustle your way to success. There's a couple of people try to say that. That ain't how you get it. Again, you can't skip the small steps. You got to put the long hours in. So what was crazy was, like, during my 30s, all of my friends were balling. Everybody's kind of past grad school, got that first wife or husband, got that first house, got that first kid, took that first big vacation, took pictures and showed, got that first foreign whip. Me, man, I'm sitting up here like trying to make $20 go a week, living in K-Town, writing really fast, working on music and typing on a computer because I don't know when my light's going to get cut off. DJing to make money, writing videos and commercials. Like, I was really living like a college student after having been a successful lawyer. Do you know what that does to your psyche after having been in the light hard? No alcoholism, no drug addiction, nothing. Didn't deal with that. Couldn't afford it, actually. Couldn't afford to be a drug addict. And I developed rules in those days. It was, don't do anything illegal and don't pray for yourself. And that's the part trips everybody out, particularly my mom. I pray for other people. To this day, I don't. Because if you want to stay believing in something, you better have two things you need to have to be successful. Have a healthy relationship with money and a healthy relationship with God. And those are two different ways you got to do it. Do I go to church? Nope. Fun fact, my minor was religious studies. It's not like I'm devoid of understanding faith, and I understand a lot of different faiths. I also still understand psychology, and I also understand, like, I was never the Jesus take the wheel guy. And I always felt that, I'm going to say this, it'll be controversial. Some people may disagree. I get the idea of faith as a supporting thing to give you the reinforcement to believe that you can overcome things. What I don't believe is that you just, the first thing you say when it gets tight, I got to go pray. No, you need to figure that shit out. And when you figure out what you're going to do, then you ask God if it's the right decision to show you. That's really what we're supposed to do. Figure it out yourself. Think about it. Pull the plane up. What's different alternatives I can take? How do we get here? Where do I want to go? what steps I got to take. Okay, I'm going to take these moves, blah, 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 blah. Let me talk to some people who's done it. Let me talk to some people who fucked it up, who didn't get there. Then say, God, am I doing the right thing? If not, show me, and I'll trust what you show me. That, I think, is a healthier relationship than, oh, I'm going to go see what God's going to do. You know, dude, you ain't even putting no, you know what I mean? And yeah, I just move like that. I move like that. I think like that. My father died 6 weeks before my book came out. He was one of the main characters in it. I had to go on a book tour rather than grieve. I've had some weird poetry in my life. And so you go through these things, you say, why now, Lord? Why now? Because my thing is this. There's another one. Here's another good one. You're going through some mess. This is how I look at it. I got two things I say to people. You got to look at the earth signs. People say, what do you mean earth signs? No, there's not no kumbaya weirdness. What's happening on the ground? Look exactly what's happening on the ground, in front of you and behind you. This is what's happening. Here's the other thing, because I've had plenty big setbacks. And the only question I ask is, what am I supposed to learn from this? I'm supposed to learn something from this. I don't know yet, but I know I'm supposed to learn something from this. Be patient and it'll show itself. And sometimes it's something you don't want to learn. And then you're like, did I have to learn it like that? Yeah, man, you had to learn it like that.
Marcus, did your dad know about your book?
Yeah, so what was crazy was the galley came out. He was in the hospital. And so he got the galley, and then the first reviews came out. And then they went from, it went from a paperback deal to a Mega Blast hardcover deal. The critical community and the New York literary world responded hard, like, yo, this is this new guy from writing about the South coming. And so it went past the expectations. He got the galley. The galley is kind of the pre-proof of the book you send out for reviews. And, you know, he had been in the hospital for a while and moved to different facilities, and he had just got used to telling nurses that the book was about him. In many ways, it is. And so he was a very proud man, in like a little braggadocious. And so what he would do is he would keep the book. My sister got him a smartphone. He would keep the book by, and people come to visit and nurse, they'd see the book. Houston artist, my cousin Angelbert Matois did the cover for the hardcover. And so it's a very colorful, off top, colorful artwork. And so we go, oh, what's this? Oh, my son wrote a book. It's all about me. Saying so they're humoring them. And then they would read, you know, God's Tears of Brown, first line of the book. And they start reading, like, whoa, like, no, this dude can write for real, right? He said, let me know when you finish the first. He would only let them read the first chapter. And they want to keep going. It's like, nope. He said, you got to order it on Amazon, pre-order it. He was my salesman. Last time I saw him, he had the book in his lap. We were talking. I came to visit him. And I had to head back to LA to get the press and publicity stuff ready for the book tour. And he died the night that my EP came out at the record release. It was weird, man. And then I had to go on book tour. And it was crazy because the people interview you. Not interview, they announce you and kind of go through some of your accolades. And it was weird, man, because it just sounded like a eulogy. Mm-hmm. I did that for 6 months. And then I came home and made a baby. That's exactly what I did. Yeah.
And how old is your baby now?
She's five. And she's him. Came back. Same attitude. The whole thing, you know. Amazing. Yeah, it was weird and selfish, but I did it.
And she's beautiful too. Oh,
thank you. Yeah. Life will give you some interesting things to work with.
Always does. So, Marcus, when you create time to relax and to have some fun, what do you do?
Play tennis.
Okay. Oh, yeah? You got some quick feet?
Not bad. That's fairly recent, like maybe 6-7 years. Close friend of mine, I used to lift weights for a while. And as I started getting older, I was looking for some things as a man to take into my older age that you could take with you. Lifting weights is the anaerobic version, and playing tennis is the aerobic version. And so a good friend of mine out here, he almost went pro. He's a dope artist and fashion designer. And he taught me, and it became an addiction. I don't play golf, I play tennis. I even got a ball machine. I don't even need nobody to hit with. I just got a spot up the street. I get up early in the morning, get my stuff, you know, do 150 backhand, 150 forehand. 40 minutes later, I'm done. Just go back, just get to work. Now I'll go get on a Peloton. I do that. That's fun. But I don't even know what that is, man. I haven't had a vacation. What's that? I need to go.
But you do like to travel. Like, what are some of the neat places maybe you want to go?
You know, you go play everywhere when you DJ house music, all over the world, you know. And I was on a, you know, on a record label that would have me all over the world. You know, it's Afro House, it's Yoruba Records, Oshun Lade. You know, I made a, you know, made big splash, got some fantastic label mates. I got a big fan base in Italy, Brazil, France, definitely. South Africa, got a big fan base down there. And one of the coolest things about house music was that it allowed me to have that kind of interaction and engagement with people who speak different languages, have different cultures, and that they respond to and are touched and moved by the music that you create. And that's another level of gratification that's kind of cool. And then when you go and DJ, you see that connection from the DJ booth, you know what I mean? And people grooving into not just your curation of music, but particularly when, because a lot of times for a long time, I wouldn't play any of my records when I go DJ. And then people start complaining, like, man, I paid $30. I want to hear hair and makeup, you know? And I was like, fuck, you know? But I get so much good music. I was like, you haven't heard this shit. Let me play this for you. And then I started later on, I started leaning into it. I just go do half the show, be my stuff, because I know people came out to hear it. And it was an entire completely different existence. You know what I'm saying? Different name. No Z Stardust weirdness. I just created a whole nother brand for it. At first, people were like, Mateo Sonoya, what's all that? Blah, blah, blah. I say, you know, I am a businessman too. I just can't do everything under Marcus Guillory. And so it worked, turned into something big, which is crazy. I'm going to tell you this. Here's the thing. So when I wrote Red Annihilators, I didn't have a book deal. And I would have been happy if some obscure university press would have done 1,000 presses and put it on Amazon. I would have been happy with that. End up getting a multi-book deal with Simon & Schuster. When I produced my first album with this thing, because I had recorded music with other people before, but this first time I was producing, I would have been cool just giving it for free on SoundCloud. I didn't think I'd get a record deal with Yoruba Records. I say that to say that my intention was to make the work. It wasn't, let me go get a deal. It was make the work and make it representative of what you want to say, you know, what you have to put out to the world. Let that be pure, not a gimmick. Everything else is going to be what it's going to be. And that's exactly what happened.
Drew and I were just having the branding discussion and just your comment about, you know, you can't do everything under one name. It just made me chuckle because it just a few days ago, we were having a very similar discussion.
A brand or branding?
Like your brand, like can't do everything under the same name concept.
Still do have sponsorships and stuff, you know. Like if I go out on, I got a new record coming out this year, probably the summer. And I already told people I ain't going nowhere. No TikTok, Twitch, none. I'm not doing any of that. You can go by and listen to it, dance at your house. But when I get ready to record, if I'm going on the road, yeah, I got Blue Mic, does my mics, Native Instruments is my equipment. You know, I have different companies when I'm out on the road. Yeah, they'll, you know, they sponsor you. But that brand, Mateo Sonoya, is has a certain thing it does. What's interesting about it, and I think what I found fun, is that people figure out, oh my God, this guy is a literary fiction novelist who produces some dope house music, and it's not a gimmick. And so it's like, yo, that's really what's going on. When I go to a TV room, when I deal with Hollywood, which is a lower common denominator, I should say, then it always trips people out that different writers will start Googling you like, holy shit, he does all this stuff. And so the question I get is, as a multi-hyphenate polymath, whatever you want to call it, how do you do all this stuff at the same time? I don't have an answer. I don't know. And I ain't trying to figure it out because I ain't trying to screw it up. I didn't go to school for anything I'm doing right now. I went to school to be a lawyer, but that was over a long time ago. So yeah, I've been flying without a parachute for a minute. And it's cool, it's fun, and gets scary. You know, when I had a kid, I had to really make some By the time I had my child, you know, things had been popping. And so, but there was also my risk aversion changed because there was dependence now. I take care of my mother and my kid. And so it's like there's people depending on me and counting on me to make the right decisions, you know, from a business standpoint. And so, like, honestly, man, like the TV money kind of underwrites my life because the TV money is bananas. TV writing money is bananas. It's crazy. It's super. Yeah, you know, my colleagues in the literary world, they're college professors and stuff like that. Yeah, that's cute. That's cool. And that's needed. And so I'm kind of like the outlier who's in Hollywood, you know, and DJing and whatnot.
The man of many talents.
No, because here's the other part. It's time. You got to respect and understand time. And that way you can get stuff done. If I say I'm going to put, like when I was working on a book, in those days I'd write 16, 17 hours a day for about a few years. And I'd work on a book for about 5-6 hours, take a break, come back, work on a bass line or a hi-hat for a few hours, take a nap, come back and review what I wrote earlier, write some more, and then go DJ somewhere and listen to what I was working on. Because that's how I started DJing. So didn't go to school for writing, got some scripts, turned into a writer. The DJing came about so I could hear the music that I was producing. I had no intention of being a DJ, none. But I knew I was doing house music, and part of that is actually being a DJ. So I hooked up with Garth Trinidad from KCRW, this big radio personality out here, who's actually my child's cousin. That's, you know, we have a small bubble. And we got a night, you know, we called it Jim Kelly because we were some black dudes in Koreatown, you know, playing music. Either you got it or you didn't get the joke. And some of the stuff I was making, and all of a sudden we started getting booked to go DJ and stuff. And so that turned into something. You feel me? That's really what happened. It's strange. Who knows? I know what's coming next, but it's interesting to see that. But at the same time, you have to avail yourself to the opportunities that present themselves. And like the Masons have a thing, they say preparation is the key. I'm not a Mason, but I do know they say that. And so what you want to be is prepared when that opportunity arrives. Worst thing to be is not prepared. You get a great opportunity and you're not ready for it. And then you're kind of like trying to jazz hand your way through it and stuff. And that ain't gonna work, bro.
Marco, let's take it back. If you can go back and speak to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh my God.
That laugh is like, do we have enough time?
I know. I'm dying to hear this one.
I like that dude, man. I obviously like who he became. Had a lot of confidence. You know, a lot of confidence. I didn't have any room to doubt anything, man. Everybody around me looked like they was doing better. And I was, but I wasn't running around carrying this poor boy thing. I worked so I could have nice clothes. I had a little Volkswagen Rabbit that I bought. I had the nice stuff, but I had to pay for that shit, man. And I understood that that didn't affect my friendship with those who didn't have to do that. My best friends, I don't think any of them, I was the only one who had a job, you know? It obviously built character. And I knew that I wasn't responsible for where I started, but I am responsible for where I head, you know? And I was very clear about that. That helped me move going forward, you know? I will tell you this much. Oh, snap, it's funny, Yvonne's on this call. Man, this is a deep dive. Only a few people who may hear this is gonna really understand it. I would tell myself this. Man, don't worry, dude. You about to be the livest motherfucker out there. Trust on that. Whatever acceptance you want that you don't think you're getting now, bro, you're going to get it at so many kind of levels. So much stuff surprises me. And some of the things that I've done I've done so many 180s. I have a movie coming out soon, so I'm availing myself to stuff like this. This may be like the fourth or fifth one I've done. I normally don't give interviews just because for me, it's always felt it's more important to let the work be in front of you and just let people deal with that.
No window shopping.
Yeah. And so, but people who know me, this was like a year or two ago, like, man, you need to do a TED talk or some stuff, man. Like, I've had a number of people ask me to talk to people like how to switch careers. Like, I've done so much way out stuff, and it isn't just luck, it's other stuff underneath it. You know, how you think about yourself, how you value your effort, your work, your, and the most critical thing is absolutely honest self-awareness, like real self-awareness, being very aware of what you have, what you don't have, how you come across. Is that effective for different things you want? You know, like really being on top of it, you know, because then you're not living some foolishness in your head. You know, you're not forever 21 and a Peter Pan in yourself. And I've seen a lot of it. I've seen cats, particularly when you get over 40 and you're looking for some different stuff. And, I, you know, you some call it a midlife thing or whatever. I've seen people Peter Pan, you know, Peter Pan their way into the doghouse, man, you know. And then they end up not having anything that you should continue to grow. I can tell you this much, Drew. I'm more excited about what I'm going to be writing at 60 than what I'm going to be writing tomorrow, just to see where my head's at that point. The experiences I have to come that's going to shape how I tell story, how I feel about what I do, the style that I do it, you know. I continue to surprise myself, and I'm not scared of that. And I'm not reluctant to be like, oh, man, I don't know, this is my comfort zone. Some of that, I think, has to do with leaving home. You know, I have friends who never left home.
So that's a huge difference.
Yeah, because you got the same eyes on you a lot of times, man. And the expectations kind of stay the same. And then people, like, they'll be in your business and they'll lay a bunch of, you know, expectations on top of that, on top of that. And they just see you. I have a lot of friends who live in Houston who you don't see. They live in Houston, but I get it. You know, one of my best friends is back there. Now, he's been there a while. He don't hang out with the same people we used to hang out with in high school. Oh, they hanging out and partying, living their best life and constantly documenting, which I think is hilarious. But, man, you know, I will tell you this for the audience, which is cute inside baseball. I'm low-key thinking about getting a place down there. Yeah, that's your hot one for the day, your hot little but I don't know how I want to emerge in Houston. Like, because this virtual thing we're doing now, I mean, I've been in Canada with my kid most of last year, working from there as long as I got a computer. And I'm like, I can get a big old sick house in Houston, like totally ball out. But then I ask myself the next question, do I want to be like, how are you going to move out there? I'm not trying to relive high school tales. I'm like, I've been five different people since that guy. Some of the universities have talked to me. I ain't gonna say their names, but I'm not interested in tenure. You know, I'm really not interested in teaching. I've done that before. And I make enough money with TV where I'm not gonna trip to get tenure to get $100,000, dude. That's whatever for that. I wouldn't mind doing a writer in residence, you know, but I do think it's important to have an association with an institution. So actually, thinking about University of Houston. Of all, not ICE, which I've spoken, yeah, you know, not TSU, U of H, because their creative writing program in the past 10 years, thanks to my friend Matt Johnson and a few other people, it's like one of the top 10 now. University of Houston's creative writing program has blown up. The whole university has blown up, actually, in terms of endowment, just moving itself up.
Let's finish there. I got an interesting question. So when I watch a movie or a TV show, I'm the type of person that always look at the intricacies. I'm the guy who loves ad-libs when it comes to music. So I'll watch a show and I'll be like, how the hell did they think of that? Or how did they write that? So just to finish off the show, put us in the writer's room. You guys are writing a TV series. What's the process look like?
So this is how it works. I'll run through it quick, because it's involved. You know, the first thing you do is you break what we call breaking the season, and you figure out what the season's going to be about. All right. Once we agree to that and get it approved by the network or whatever, they'll have some notes. Then we go to breaking an episode. Now, an episode works like this. If it's a streamer, it's going to go straight through. If it's going to have commercials, it could be 5 acts. You know, it's a commercial break after each act, it could be 7 acts. I think Empire was 7 acts, might be a teaser. Teases that little piece before the main titles comes on. That's after your recaps. And then you say, what's happening in this episode? What do, for each of these characters, what do we want? Where do we want to land? You know, we know we're going to go here later on. We have to set this up and then try to create dramatic tension, consequences, characters taking actives, proactive moves, and sometimes reacting to things that change their perspective. It's super duper involved. When you're in a writer's room, you know, you got, you know, a bunch of writers in there, and we got a, what we call a board.
How many writers typically?
Depends on the show. Like on Empire, we had like 16. I'm on Law and Order now, and we got like 6. You know, it depends. You know, a lot of times it depends on how many episodes need to be written. A normal network show like an Empire or Law and Order is typically 20 to 23 episodes. And so as a writer, you're probably going to write 2. And so you need enough writers in there just to actually physically do the work to turn out the outlines and drafts and all that stuff. But when you're in the room, everyone's pitching ideas, this might work, that might not work, you know, and it's involved. If that doesn't work, try something. Keep pitching on something. Keep pitching on it.
So it's a lot of brainstorming. It's 6 people in the room just talking. Constantly talking and brainstorming.
Oh yeah, it's involved. You are mentally fatigued when it's done. If it's real hot and y'all going in, and it's like y'all trying, and then sometimes you got moments where you know you got to re-break something, like something ain't working, and you get a call from the network like I got to start over. Long couple of days, you know. But that's what the money's for, like we said, because they pay you handsomely.
Well, thanks for taking us down that journey, Marcus. We really thank you for your time today. Your story has been amazingly intriguing and inspiring at the same time. So we appreciate your time today, my man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Marcus, it was a blessing to grow up with you. It's an honor to call you friend, and just thank you for being you.
I appreciate it.
Writer and producer, Marcus J. Guillory.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To the athletes, keep being the best you can be. Run your race with excellence. To the parents of athletes, let's continue to support our children with patience, grace, and understanding, learning to recognize how to truly become the guides and the stewards that we are supposed to be. To everyone, be willing to share your experiences to help others along their paths. And always be open to the wisdom that comes your way.
For more information about the 21 Podcast, 21 Media, and services provided by Train Harder 21, visit the website at drewlasker.com and follow us across all social media platforms. Remember to add this podcast to your playlist, subscribe, rate, and review. Until next episode of 21, Train Harder.